Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Deborah Eckerling, author of Your Goal Guide and creator of The Deb Method for Goal Setting Simplified. You can't reach your goals on your own, you need your people. So every week I bring together some of my people to dive into the special topic. And today we are talking about your voice. That's what it's there for, to use it more, develop it. A really wonderful panel we have with us today, Stacia Crawford, who's a media strategist. So we've got that aspect. David H. Lawrence the 17th, who is, you're going to recognize your voice probably, his voice probably more than everything else, but he also helps authors to narrate their own books, so voice that way. And then Richard Walter, who is a ages professor, but screenwriter and author, and he's got a new book out, and it really is all about your voice and all these aspects. And this is what I love to do, is bring together people who don't know each other, but on a really vague topic, so we could just dig in and have some fun. So if you're tuning in live to Goal Chat, we thank you. You might be listening to this as the Goal Chat podcast on the Marketing Podcast Network. No matter how you found us, we are glad you're here and expressing interest in your voice, and I guess using it better, stronger, developing it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Stacia, let's start with you. Who are you? Well, I know, but why are you here and why do you love this topic?
I love this topic because that is what I do. I actually help people who want to share their voice, use their voice to share their message. So I am a media strategist and publicity strategist. So I help people to get in front of audiences where they can use their voice to talk about topics and messages that are important to them. So for many people, that may be talking about your business, because of course you need eyes on your business in order to get more customers, in order to make more money. And that means sharing your voice. It means actually creating your own narrative in mass media. I've been a storyteller for over 30 years. I worked as a television news producer for 3 decades. So that's really where my love for the voice and storytelling came into play as a news producer. And now as a strategist, really helping people to kind of use those platforms and those channels to share their messages. It's important because this is how we spark conversation. This is how we relate to people. So your voice is absolutely a valuable and vital tool for your business.
Well, if there's something people know about me, it's that I love to talk, and it's through conversations and amplifying voices that you learn, grow, develop. So really glad you're here. David H. Lawrence the 17th. Good to see you, my friend.
Nice to see you too.
So please share who you are, why you're here, and we'll go from there.
So I'm an actor in Los Angeles, voice talent long before I was an actor. I didn't become an actor until I turned 50. So it's a second act in life for me. People who know my face may know me from a show called Heroes, where I played one of the creepy evil villains, but I'm not a creepy evil villain in real life. And I've been doing voiceover for about 45 years now, radio, television. I worked as a news anchor for a while, so worked with people who did what Stacia did. Now what I do, for the most part, is... I continue my acting career, but I also do a lot of audiobook narration and training of actors and voice talent. And as of this week,
woohoo!
Authors who want to narrate their own books. The students that I've taught in the past have all been professional actors and voice talent, and collectively, they are responsible for about 7,000 of the books that you'll find on Audible over the last 10 years. And the authors that occasionally sneak into my class and then reveal themselves at some point as, quote, not actors, I have to disabuse them of that and remind them that they are now officially actors. So I figured let's create a version of this training that is specific and focused on what authors need to do to narrate their own books. And so narrateyourownbook.com/deb is where you'll find a series of free lessons. And we're just like, literally, you're catching me on the day that I begin these free. I didn't even have a chance to change out of my shirt that I used to record the first lesson. So,
well, and you did inspire the conversation and the timing of the conversation. So it sounds like it wasn't planned, but we all know it's totally planned.
Totally.
And I think, especially as an author, there's no greater compliment when someone tells you, oh, I hear your voice in my head as I am reading your book. Well, the next best thing would be actually hearing their voice as you are reading the book to them. So I think what you're offering is completely just such a valuable resource as an author and someone who works with authors. I so get it. So I'm really excited that you're here. So from the training of authors to talk, a talking author, Richard Walter.
Yeah, you know, the funny, the second book that I published, my new novel, Deadpan, has just come out. It's my third novel. I do have three books, God forgive me, on screenwriting. And the first one, I actually wrote by recording lectures that I was giving at UCLA. I was a professor for over 40 years at UCLA. I led the screenwriting program in the film school. And I mainly worked in seminar situations with just eight writers around the table, writing a screenplay. I also occasionally did lecture to large groups of audiences, of students there taking a fundamental screenwriting lecture course. And I recorded those lectures. There were 10 lectures and there's 10 chapters in the book. And then I transcribed those, and they were the actual written record of what I had actually spoken, my actual voice, and it didn't sound like me at all. One of the greatest compliments that I've had as a writer is people saying to me of that book, "Gee, Richie, reading the book, it sounds just like the way you talk." I've constantly worked with writers about talking about their voices and the voices of characters in their screenplay. And you see a lot of errs and ums, vocalized pauses, and or look, or listen, and I really mean that, and stuff like that. And I would urge people not to use stuff like that. And very, very frequently people say, but that's the way people really talk. Mm-hmm. Well, is it the way people really talk? It is. So what's wrong with that? Two things. Second of all, we'll come to first of all in a moment. But second of all, you don't need to go to the movies to hear the way people really talk. You can just go out in the street. I took a walk this morning and I ran into neighbors walking their dogs around the neighborhood. Hi, how you doing? Pretty good. Beautiful day. Yeah, how about that rain? Wasn't that something supposed to rain this weekend? That's the way people really talk. So what's wrong with that? First of all, it's boring.
Boring.
The way you have to talk in a book, especially if you're writing, let's say, a screenplay, or as I've just finished, a dramatic narrative that's in fictional form as literature, everything you say must, I think, first of all, be worth listening to all for itself. Mm-hmm. It just has to be peppy and perky and punchy. And but it can't be all for itself. It also has to move the story forward in a palpable, measurable, identifiable way. And it has to expand the audience's or the reader's appreciation of the characters. That sounds like two things, but it's really one thing. I think, you move the story forward by expanding the characters. You expand the characters by moving the story forward. So I think I closed my opening comment by simply saying that the way you really, your actual real voice won't do if it's simply transcribed and written down. That I've heard writers say this over the years, there's nothing more true about writing than this, that real writing is a rewriting. Spill it out and get it down on the page. But after that, the real work starts. One of my most successful graduates, former students, is David Koepp, K-O-E-P-P. He's written several pictures for Steven Spielberg, a hugely successful writer. He says that the secret of his success, Lawrence, you like this, is the number, David, you will like this, it's the number 17. And what he means by that is that's how many drafts he has to write. And people say, somebody said to me the other day, gee, I've been through this 6 times already. Well, she's just warming up, although she might not get it, we get it.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like you're jumping the line, which is fine. I'm totally good with this. Because your voice, it's a powerful tool. But what does that mean? What is your, air quotes, voice? Stacia, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I think your voice is really, like you were saying, you know, you have those words swimming around in your head. That's really what your voice is, because that's where it starts. You know, as a media strategist, you know, even to Richard's point, was that, you know, you can't write like you talk. And the same thing, like when I'm working as a media trainer, you're using your voice when you're going on television and you're, you know, delivering your message, giving your narrative, you're using your voice, but it can't be just the way that you speak. We do, right? A lot of ums, likes, you know, that kind of stuff. And that doesn't do when you're in a situation where every second counts. When you have a media interview and you have 3 minutes, maybe four, you could have as much as 5 minutes. You've got to make every second count. Just like when you're in the written word, you've got to make every word count. You want that audience holding on to every word that you say, where one word leads to the next and they can't turn away or they can't close that book. That is your voice. It's those images that are in your head. It's those words that are in your head that have been carefully curated and either placed on a page or spewed out of your mouth in a way that resonates with the people that you're trying to reach. In this case, you know, for me, it would be for a television audience. So that's really what your voice is.
I love that. And in a way that resonates, I think is probably the most important. But I mean, all your words were great, but that resonating, you know, speaking to, not just speaking at. David, something to add sure. to this definition? I bet you do.
Sure. Richard brought up the whole notion of vocalization bridges and filler words and so on. And those all come from fear. You know, put yourself at a party where you're talking to somebody and your fear is if you don't keep their attention 100% of the time, they're going to look over your shoulder and find somebody else more interesting at the party. And so you say, and you know, so like, I didn't really, so let me just make sure you understand what I'm saying. And you create this patina of words to just arrest their attention. I can tell you that if you were to pause, you would arrest them a lot faster because they would come back to you to see if you'd had a medical event. Are you okay? Like when you get to the point where you're going to let something powerful land, do let it land. It's one of the things that I train my clients on is this notion of being comfortable with negative space when you're speaking. That silence, that moment when you've dropped the bombshell, if you don't wait and let it percolate a little bit, you're blunting its force. And so when I work with the CXO level suite people that I do when they're being trained in media and talking head stuff, I always tell them little things like don't thank the anchor for having you on their show. That's a valuable 4 seconds that you could be using to share your company's message or share your organization's message. Don't sit there and go, look, that's rude. It's invasive. It's insulting. We don't have to look. We're watching you. We know what you're doing. We know what you're saying. Don't say, look, politicians do it all the time. They used to point at you with their thumbs. They've thankfully stopped doing that now. But we've generated these habits over decades, and they're constantly evolving, where we're afraid of losing someone's attention. And the good news is when you're narrating an audiobook, the words are right in front of you and they can do all the heavy lifting. You don't have to worry about inserting vocalization bridges and those sort of things. Just have the courage to know that your voice is enough. You know, we tend to grow up with this notion of my voice is horrible. I hate the way I sound. You hear yourself the first time when you're recorded, and I've heard people describe it as sounding like Mickey Mouse or tinny or whatever. And there's a very straightforward reason for that. And that is that when you speak, you're hearing yourself two different ways at the same time. You're hearing yourself through the air, which is convective. The voice goes out and bounces off all the walls and the people and everything. And you're hearing your voice, which is very bassy, coming up through your muscles and your bones in your ear. So you get this mixture of those two voices. And you can hear that conductive voice if you just cover your ears and listen to your voice that way without hearing the convective voice. You don't get that bass part when you're listening to a recording. And so you think, oh, I sound tinny, I'm awful. And the fact of the matter is that you're hearing yourself the way everybody else hears you, and they're not squinting. They're not, oh, don't stop talking, for God's sakes. So once you understand that, it can help you accept how great your voice can be.
Mm-hmm. Love that so much. Richard, anything to add about what?
Well, I really like what David said about, in a way, David, I hope I'm not misspeaking for you. Often what you don't say is more powerful than what you do say. Here's a joke. The doctor says to the patient, I have bad news and I have worse news. The patient says, well, give me the worst news first. He says, well, it's cancer. It's metastatic. It's inoperable. You don't have 3 months to live. And the guy says, oh, my goodness. And what's the news that's just bad? And he says, well, you also have dementia. You have Alzheimer's disease. So the guy says, oh, my goodness. Well, at least I don't have cancer. Now, people laugh at that. What's funny about cancer and dementia? We all know people, certainly people my age know people who struggle with these issues. There isn't a thing about it. Why is that funny? Because it's text and subtext. It's what you say, what you hear on one hand, and what you mean on the other. And when you do it that way, you compel the listener, the observer, to engage with you. It's not just video games and computer games that are interactive. All art, all expression is interactive. So what you don't say, the less is more. You know, it's funny you talk about voices swimming in your head. I was a swimmer when I was in college, and I used to swim up in the pools at UCLA. And in 1988, the Olympics were in Seoul, Korea. And the coach of the American women's swim team brought all of the women swimmers to Los Angeles. They lived in Texas and Florida and California, pretty much what you'd expect, wouldn't you? And the idea was they would train for 2 weeks in Los Angeles, then 2 weeks in Honolulu, and then 2 weeks before the games in Seoul, so that there would be no jet lag. They would be completely acclimated. In a sport like swimming, a few hundredths of a second is the difference between gold and zilch. And so there were all of these really famous swimmers there, including Janet Evans. She had this terribly sloppy stroke, too splashy, too choppy. It wasn't a long, graceful thing. She did everything wrong, according to the textbooks, except one thing. She was so fast, the water boiled around her. Now, there were a lot of press there because there were these athletic stars. And I overheard an interview that the coach, the women's swim team coach, was giving to a reporter. The reporter was asking him, why don't you work on Janet Evans with her stroke? It's too splashy, it's too this, it's too that. And he said something that I'll never forget. It's very, very useful advice for athletic coaches teaching athletes. Also for teachers in the arts, as I was, teaching artists, writers in my case, and also I think for parents raising children. He said, part of the job of being a coach is showing the way, and the other half is getting out of the way. And I think over my years working with so many writers as I have, really, really good writers, we were very privileged at UCLA. It's a very competitive program, easier to get into the Harvard Medical School than the UCLA screenwriting program. So the writers we worked with were really smart, and sometimes too smart for their own good. They intellectualized, they got in their own way. I think you have to stop listening to your voice and just let it out. And when you write it down, it won't be quite right, but it'll be sort of right. And then it's what we said before, reshaping, sculpting, editing, and that's the real work. And I think that the writers who succeed do that It's about giving it the time. The writers that don't succeed, I think, just won't give that the time. Remember, time is your life. I mean, it is more to your life than just time, but that's the measure of your life, isn't it? And so what you really have, if you're doing in the arts, you have to give your life. What art wants is your life. But that's not a brooding or a dark notion. I can't imagine anything. I feel so fortunate at my age to have lived a life in which I could literally swap my daydreams for dollars, traffic in my own imagination. What could be more wonderful than that? It's unique to the human condition, isn't it? I mean, elephants don't do it. Amoebas don't do it. Only humans do it. And I think that's what artists need to be doing.
Really good points. And there go the filler words. David, you're killing me here. Well, the audience is, you know, writers, creatives, entrepreneurs, because if you're one, you're the other too, because entrepreneurs need to be creative and write, et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to go through all of my definitions, but some people are, I don't want to say afraid of their voice, maybe unsure of their voice. So what can people do to better develop their voice and, you know, run towards the ideas, not from them? David?
You know, I think you're asking the wrong question.
What is the right question?
The right question is to become at peace and with grace with the voice that you have and to honor the power that is already there. You know, we tend to think, oh, my voice isn't good enough. And that's the assumption. So how do I make it better? And the truth of the matter is that I can think of very few people. There are going to be people on this that are watching this that have no idea who Wally Cox is. And if you did know who Wally Cox was, it was because likely you watched Saturday morning cartoons when you were a kid and there was a show called Underdog and he was the voice of Underdog. He was also on Hollywood Squares. And right now I've just declared myself to be a 65-year-old. So the fact of the matter is
both of those things. So,
that's yes, why.
Mr. Peepers.
Yeah, exactly. Mr. Peepers. Now you're identifying yourself as 140 years old. But Wally Cox had arguably an awful voice. It was whiny. He had a couple of speech impediments. It was high pitched. It fit his look. He had a look of a nerd and he was, you know, it fit his look. But when they were looking for the voice of Underdog, there wasn't anybody who could possibly have competed with him.
Right.
And being at peace with that, I'm sure, is something that he may have struggled with, but he certainly wasn't struggling living in his, you know, mansion up in the hills here. And so I think one of the things that you might want to consider is that your voice is far better than you think it is. It's far better than the self-effacing, self-destructive value that you assign it. Maybe because you're trying to be aw shucks, gee whiz, or maybe you really feel like your voice needs to be better. I had somebody who wrote me today who'd watched the video that you'll find if you go to Deb's link. And she said, my voice sucks worse than my book. And I'm like, wow, okay. I've got some mindset work to do with you. You know, I teach from four different tent poles. I teach from art, science, commerce, and mindset. And the mindset part is often the hardest for artists to accept in terms of a thing they need to be better at. So that's, I think, the question that we need to ask is how can we value the voice that we have, be at peace with it, and use it to its fullest extent?
Well, first of all, I'm going to thank you for correcting me. And I did change the question to how can you honor your voice? But this is what's kind of goofy. So I'm the goal girl. But as I mentioned before, one of the things that I love to do is work with entrepreneurs and consultants who've got that book in their head that they can't quite get out of their head. So my superpower is talking to them and being able to ask the right questions to pull the right answer. And this is what I say. You know, your story is your background. Own it. Find your uniqueness, which is a parallel to exactly what you said. So,
David, it wasn't really a correction, was it?
It was a sharp turn.
I thought it was like an alignment. You know,
okay, we'll go. So what can people do to honor their voice?
Can I give another perspective on that? I podcast, and I do 2 a week, and I've been doing them for years, and they're very by thousands and thousands of people. I have never listened to one of my podcasts. I can't stand them. Whenever I hear myself, I think I should have said this, I shouldn't have said that. I have had the privilege in my life of crossing paths with some of the most successful writers in literature and certainly in film. And I never met one that was really pleased with the way anything came out. I remember a meeting, Julius Epstein, he wrote he wrote Casablanca. And I said to him, what a thrill to meet you. All I or any of my film phony pals ever hoped for was once we should touch something, as timeless and eternal as Casablanca. And wouldn't it be nice if I could tell you that? He said, thank you very much. That's so kind of you. No, he's a writer. He said, Casablanca, Schmasablanca, they messed that up. You know, the part where blah, 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 and we wanted and we, but no, here he is griping and carping and complaining how they messed his movie. What movie? Casablanca. I just wish somebody would mess up my movie like they messed up his movie. Every once in a while I'll meet a writer, a new writer who'll say to me, boy, I'm working on something now and it is just going so well. Everything's falling into place. I'm so optimistic about this. There's just no way this thing can't be stopped. It can't be held back. And I always say the same thing to them. I always say, well, that's wonderful. Congratulations. And I also always say to myself the same thing, which is amateur. Amateur. I read my own books and I'm rewriting them in my head. And I don't know any writer who's has any kind of success, who's sustained any kind of a living out of this, who is different about it. So stop trying to be satisfied. And, we're all wretched sinners on God's green earth. Only God and the universe is perfect. What we are is imperfect. You have to own that. And you have to quit fighting for something that you can never achieve, which is perfection.
David, a response, and then you could chime in, Stacia.
I really want to make sure Stacia's voice is heard here, because I would go to news directors and news producers all the time with story ideas, and I would be shot down. So I just want to make sure she's heard. But I will tell you that the humanity in our voices comes from the imperfections. We think that we will be better appreciated, recognized, consumed at a higher rate if we're perfect, if we're better than we are right now. And the truth is, if we're more human than we are right now, we'll be consumed to the point where we have nothing left to give. You know, when you think about the people, the flaws that people have that draw you to them, especially their voices, you know, sure, it's great when you have a voice that is resonant and deep and sexy and all of the things that we put on pedestals in terms of attributions about our voice, but the reality and the authenticity and the humanness of the voice is so much more valuable. And that's what I think is surprising to people when they take my courses, because I don't say things like, let's do some vocal exercises so that your voice is deeper. Let's do this, let's do that. Things that you might expect a singing coach to do.
Right.
Because there you have a standard that's completely different. You know, one of the things that I have to break my students of, a habit that they might have if they're singers, is that they gasp for air. When you're singing, you're putting so much sound pressure behind what you're doing. You're fairly shouting with a melody. And when you take those breathing exercises where you're holding a long note and then you have to go and get the breath in before you do the next long note, that can translate into audiobook narration, and it's noticeable when you say a sentence and then you go and then you do the next sentence. You have to stop that. You have to be careful about that. Breathing in general is an issue, Thank God Billie Eilish won for What Was I Made For. Every other sound in that song is a deep breath picked up by the microphone so beautifully in that song. And it keeps winning Song of the Year in all these different award shows, which is awesome. But Stacia, go for it.
that was so much there. Yes. So, oh my gosh. And even as you were speaking, I was like, oh yeah, I want to make sure I talk about that. Ooh, want to put a pin in.
It's all gone now, right? No, I'm okay. Kidding.
Right. So I will start with, how can you honor your voice simply by using it? Again, right, going back to the whole concept of being perfect. I do media training as well. So in addition to, you know, writing and, you know, speaking and doing interviews, preparing people for that. And part of that comes from the first thing that you have to do is make sure you have something that's worth saying that people actually want to listen to. And part of that is, you know, it's practicing. It's, you know, when you're doing media interviews, you don't have time to stumble. You don't have time to think and figure out, you know, where am I going? You gotta know, right? You gotta know. So practice makes perfect. But again, going back to that concept of perfect, perfect doesn't necessarily mean that there are no flaws. Perfect is what message are you sending that audience is going to be able to hang on to? I have sometimes clients who will do a media interview and they'll come off the set and they're like, oh my God, that sucked. Oh my goodness, that was terrible. And then they, you know, they're getting people going to their website and they're getting people who, you know, want to work with them and they're selling books and all this stuff. And then you have other people who come off and they go, oh my God, that was a great interview. It was perfect. And they get crickets. So really what is perfect is not necessarily about what looks perfect to you. It's what's resonating with that audience. People don't want perfect. They want people who are like them. We see so much perfection when we look at social media. Everything is perfect, right? We're shooting these videos and it looks awesome and wonderful and incredible. And in the, you know, the background and on the sides, it's a mess. That is really, you know, we got to stop that. People want folks to share messages that they can relate to. How many times do you hear someone tell a story, you know, and you're going, oh my gosh, me too. You went through that? So did I. That's, you know, honoring your voice, being willing to speak about your personal experiences, being willing to speak about those things that affected you, being willing to speak about the things that bother you, right? What ticks you off? Willing to speak about the things that give you joy. To me, that's honoring your voice, just being willing to use it. Use your voice, even when you feel like it's not worthy. Use it because you're going to find someone who resonates with it. And literally, it can be a game changer for you. And, you know, you might even be changing somebody else's life and giving them permission to honor and use their own voice.
You know, I love what you're saying, Stacia. What I'm hearing is whatever your voice is, what it's saying is really important. You know, years and years ago at our graduation, our commencement at UCLA, we had the James Earl Jones as the commencement speaker. Nobody has a more beautiful voice than James. And people were saying, and they commonly say, you know, James could read the phone book and people would jump. But the truth is, if James Earl Jones read the phone book, he would not get very far into the A's before people would be yawning and bored. It really, really is important what that voice is saying. And then I going back to what talking about the singing. There, you know, think of Louis Armstrong was a wonderful singer. He didn't have a traditionally familiar, smooth voice. Some of the great blues singer. I'm a particular fan of blues. You know, they've got scratchy, unorthodox sounds that are wonderfully unschooled in the sense that they're real. You know, I drive around town listening to a guy my age. I'm listening to the 50s and 60s on satellite radio, and I'm hearing classics that of the doo-wop era that are kind of pitchy. And I've heard them redone years later by professional trained schooled singers, and you get what beautiful music it is, but there is a charm and to the amateurism of the raw street sound. Remember, amateur means amateur, it means love, somebody who does it for love instead of for money. And that's what I think has to come through, is the artist's love for what she's doing.
Well, and I think a common theme for all of you is a love, a passion for. So where did that passion for what you do come from, Stacia?
I think for me, part of that came from when I was an intern. I was working in Philadelphia and I was working as an intern in the news department. And I had just gotten there, didn't really understand who really did what and what the roles were. And I noticed just an inequity in the news coverage. You know, how, you know, it was all, you know, white men, all the experts were white men, anybody who had anything important to say were all white men. And I remember seeing this woman who would come into the newsroom and she would give the directions. Oh, we're doing this story, we're not doing that. And then I would watch her show and I'm seeing it's a little bit different. I'm seeing some diversity. And so that's really where it came from for me, because it was like giving voice to the voiceless, those people who may not have otherwise had opportunities to share their ideas, to create their own narratives and share their own narratives. And that's when I recognized that this is something that was necessary. And I loved seeing it. And I love being able to elevate those voices that would otherwise go unheard. And that's really where it all started for me. That's really where the passion and the love started brewing.
Great story, coming from inspiration, but also from seeing what's out there and figuring out which way that you can elevate it that is authentic for you.
Absolutely.
And David?
So two things stick out for a long time. When I was a child, the movie Guizhou and the fact that I grew up falling in love with radio, and the fact that I could pick up distant radio stations with a little transistor radio under my pillow. Those two things were the things that really set me down the track that I went down. Guizhou was a Jackie Gleason film where he played a deaf mute. He had no lines, didn't use his voice at all.
Wow.
And I was sitting there on the living room floor, and I remember asking my mom, why am I feeling so sad for this guy? He was falsely accused of molesting a young girl because he was, you know, a deaf mute and couldn't defend himself. And I'd seen Jackie Gleason on my television every Sunday night, right? From the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami, Florida. And then the whole radio thing, it just fired my imagination like crazy. And then I spent 35 years in radio. And so those were the two big things that led me to what I do.
And so what inspired that move from off camera to on camera?
The fact that, you know, we all say I wouldn't do a single thing differently. I would do one thing differently. I would move to Los Angeles in the 80s rather than in the early 2000s, because I feel like I missed the entire golden age of reruns and residuals. But at the same time, I gained a life experience that made the move into on camera at a later stage in life a very different experience. I don't know that I would have been the same person. I know I wouldn't have been the same person, but it certainly, I would have given it, I would give that a shot. Nothing else. I feel like I have done well, and I feel like I've lived a great life. And the one thing that I would like to do is have more of what I've found since I moved to Los Angeles and started working on camera. But if I had to do it all over again, fine. If I have to do it the way I did it, I did it the way I did it.
Well, we are, and I'm certain Stacia would agree on this, as would Richard. We're all here. We got here a certain way, and our authority is because of the path that we took, the experiences, both personal and professional, that we want to put out into the world. Now, Richard, where did your storytelling spark come
from?
Well,
I think all people have feelings and have emotions and so on. I think artists, and I have crossed paths with many, many artists because of my scores of years at UCLA. I never met anybody who didn't consider himself, herself, themselves to be really, really passionate, to feel their feelings intensely, strongly. Now, I am not an evangelical Christian. I only tell you that because years ago I was invited to address an evangelical Christian conference in Chicago. 500 pastors from all across the nation gathered in Chicago for the weekend. Why me? Because the subject was narrative in scripture. You know, scripture, whether it's the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament or the Quran, there's advice, there's counsel of all kinds, but mainly it's stories. And by the way, they're not reassuring and calming stories. They're really, really difficult and sad and violent stories. And what I was saying to the preachers in Chicago was, if you want to keep people in the church, even after they leave the church on Sunday morning, by which I mean if you want them to continue to heft and consider and weigh their sermon the rest of the day, and if it's a really good sermon, how about the rest of the week or the rest of their lives? They do not have to make the people feel good. They just have to make them feel.
Mm.
And I tell screenwriters the same thing. Imagine you're walking past a movie theater and suddenly the doors open, the screening is just finished, and everybody comes out and they're all sobbing. I mean, just sobbing, weeping. Would you say to yourself, I mean, it might seem logically that you might say to yourself, gee, that's a really sad movie. Those people are so unhappy. I want to find out what that movie was and not go. No, you would immediately get in line. You'd stand up your day to get in line to see that. What if you were walking down the street and you encountered somebody who was like wobbling and uneasy and short of breath, and you're such a generous and humane person that you help that person and you lead them over to, let's say there's a bus stop and a bench, and they sit them down and you say, should I call 911? You're right. And let's say the person says no. They're kind of catching their breath and calming down and say, no, I'm all right. Thank you so much. God bless you. You're such a generous soul. All that happened to me is I saw this movie. I just came out of this movie. It is so upsetting. It is so disturbing. It's so mournful and sad. Would you say to yourself, well, I sure don't want to see. No, you would immediately go to see that movie. It's the movie theater or the space in front of the flat screen. It's a safe place where you can experience simulated happenstance, but the feeling is, I mean, nothing is phonier than a movie. It's all broken up. It's not Butch and Sundance. It's Paul and Bob, but the feelings, the emotions are real. Scare someone half to death, make them weep, make them angry. They will pay attention to what you're doing and you'll be fulfilling your purpose as an artist.
Mm. I love this conversation so much. And I hope those, whether you're listening or watching, you're getting inspired to create, whether what you create is fiction, nonfiction, or just finding more better ways to share your voice. What are some goals we can gift to the audience? What is something, and I'm going to change the question. You will like this, David. What is something someone could do today, tonight, tomorrow to honor their voice? And I'm going to, the first goal to you, David H. Lawrence, the 17th.
You know, reframing is a big thing to me. When you take a look at a situation, you go, this isn't working for me. I got to make a change here. Maybe the change that you can make is how you look at it. And I think that's the message that I wanted to share when you asked the question about how can we make our voice better. And you know, this notion of counting our wins, we tend to ignore our wins and concentrate on our losses or the insults from others or the criticisms that are not constructive, as opposed to all of the great successes that go unnoticed all day long with our lives. So know that when you are telling a story to a significant other or to a family member or a friend, and they're not cowering in fear because your voice is so awful, that's actually a win. And recognizing the fact that you have a story to tell, you have a point of view, you live in a country, I don't know where people are watching this, I'm assuming mostly in the United States and Canada, but you know, you live in a country where freedom of speech is valued and relative rights are valued, and you have the opportunity to express yourself in a way that puts you on the bus bench with that person, or puts you in the newsroom with the news director who's making decisions. And I would just note that you're far better than you often think you are. And you might want to just sort of put that on a little index card and carry it around with you.
I am all about the wins, because the wins are what motivate you to move forward. So amazing. Thank you for that so much. Richard, goal?
Well, I have something controversial to say about goals. They say you can't have it all, but I have it. I feel like I have it all. I have great family. I have a creative, I work with creative writers, creative colleagues, and so on. I was a tenured full professor for over 40 years at UCLA. That was never my goal. When I look at my early, my college writing, it's not very terribly, I'm not terribly encouraged by it. If I saw it from a student who wasn't myself, I wouldn't be particularly, optimistic about it. I came to UCLA because I was at a party in Malibu that I went to reluctantly. I felt I owed the host of that party, had been very supportive of my career, and if I would feel snubbed, and so my wife and I, we dragged our butts out there to the beach, and as I walked in the door, somebody said, "This is the guy was telling," and suddenly I was invited to do that. Now, I am a trained actor, David. I don't pursue acting because I believe that the only reason there are actors is there should be one group that suffers greater pain and is treated more shabbily than writers. But I am a longtime member of SAG-AFTRA. I no longer even pay the dues. I can say things very convincingly that I don't believe. And here it is about goals. If you want to succeed at, remember, I don't believe this. If you want to succeed at something that's really, really competitive, and what's more competitive than Hollywood, than show business, than entertainment, than writing for the screen, you must focus. You must have clear goals. You mustn't be given over to distraction. I mean, doesn't that sound reasonable? But I'm here to tell you, it's the distractions that pay off. Most of the people that I know who are successful are also surprised by what they do. They didn't really expect to be doing what they're doing. I think your best bet often in life is to kind of stumble around blindly and stupidly, and to make yourself available to the stream that's going past you. And when you bang into something that you love, grab onto it and hold on to it. And stay open to the surprises. Stay open to the surprises in your life narrative, and also in the screenplay that you're writing. I can't tell you how many times writers said to me, "Well, what I'm trying to do here." Well, stop trying to do that, and just sort of see what happens. It's not going to be brilliant, but it'll be better, and then you make it more brilliant as you work through it. But there's no way. I think you cut yourself off often by too precisely defining where you want to be and when you want to be. You know, growing up in New York City, as I did, the greatest thing you could be is a doctor. There's nothing more focused than a doctor. You know, what you study in college, and you go to pre-med and med and internship and residency and so on. And I know a lot of doctors, and some of them are very happy. You know, they're here in the healing arts, they're respected, they make good livings. But I know many who are not. This one wishes he was an oceanographer, and that one wanted to be an anthropologist. And we get many of them over the years in the screenwriting program at UCLA. They want to live creative lives. So stop over planning. And again, stay open to the surprises. If your script runs off the rails, that might be a good thing.
Okay. I am going to respectfully agree, but disagree with you. And I did manage to turn it into a goal. The goal from Richard is allow yourself to get distracted, which is great. So I am all The D and the Dead method is determine your mission. So when you know who you are, what you are about, then you could pursue that life that you desire. So it is allowing yourself to be open, but to be open with purpose. So I think we agree and disagree simultaneously, which is like all kinds of awesome. So thank you.
Well, no extra credit, no extra credit for agreeing with the professor.
I'm taking my gold star anyway. Thank you very much. Stacia, what goal do you want to gift?
I think the goal would be to not worry about what other people think. I think we live in a society where we shut ourselves down, we quiet ourselves down because we're so worried. What if I don't say the right thing? What if people disagree with me? I can't take the rejection. What if I don't do it right? And, to that, it's okay. It's okay. Don't compare yourself to someone else. Your voice is your voice. Your message is your message. It's unique to you. And knowing what you really want to do with it, what is the purpose of the message that you want to share? What do you want people to feel? What do you want them to think? What do you want them to do? And I think when you do that, you'll be okay. Just continue to, share your voice, spread your message, and just be you.
Being you, I think, are highly underrated for sure. So I think part of honoring your voice, embracing your voice is, to hit that pause button and either figure out who you are or remember who you are. Why did you get into whatever this business is? Why are you a creative? Why are you in this business? Why are you helping others? What is that motivation?
Yeah.
And allow that to spark.
Yeah. And sometimes, we downplay our own power because we're so busy looking at somebody else and comparing ourselves to them. But, I say, this is yours. This is your voice and it's your message. So, wield it powerfully.
I think and so the purpose of the show is really to inspire, to motivate. And I think you all have done such a wonderful job. It's like, you are you, exclamation point, asterisk, highlight, own it so you can best move forward to have that life that you want, that you desire, and get those surprises along the way. Stacia, where can people learn more about you and all you have to offer?
Yes, you can go to beseengetbookedsession.com. And you can go there. There's information about me, my business, my services. There's also a couple of videos. So some things that you can actually learn to begin to get publicity for your message, to begin to share your message with the world. You want to get yourself booked on television. It's absolutely possible. Radio, get written about in magazines. Share your message with the world because people need to know your name. People often don't realize that they're doing some powerful, powerful work. And you can have the greatest business, you can have the strongest message, but if nobody gets to hear it, what's the point? So let's get it out there.
I love the use of understatements. Amazing. Thank you. David H. Lawrence, the 17th, where can people learn more about you?
Right there on your screen, narrateyourownbook.com/deb. All this week, we have some free lessons that really illustrate what I'm trying, and this is the first time that I presented this to this constituency, but there's three free lessons. They're each about an hour long that are presenting what I'm trying to help authors who want to add voice to the written word. Currently, 12 of the top 20 New York Times bestsellers are voiced by the author. And I want to bring that to the rest of the known universe, not just the top 20 books. In the world, and Deb has been so gracious to help us with this inaugural launch.
Well, this is also the power of the socials, right? You and I met, David, like 7-8 years ago at Social Media Marketing World in San Diego, and we haven't seen each other since then. And then he posts that he's working on this thing and, you know, instant spark to reconnect. Stacy and I, we've been connected for a couple years in my original media person scheduled for today. Sick. I hope you're feeling better. There she was this morning. And I was saying before we went live, I like to think you would have come to my mind immediately, but I didn't have to think because you were right there.
Right there.
And Richard, who I've known for years from when I did work at the Writer's Store and their newsletter, we reconnected to come back. So I love that I've got these connections that I get to share you all with my people, and you get to share yourselves with each other. So thank you. Thank you, social media, which we all love, hate. Actually, social media is next week's Gold Chat topic, so be sure to tune in. Richard, where can people learn more about you?
Well, I've already said richardwalter.com is your best bet. It'll take you to my site, and you can find out about my current book. You'll be able to click onto biography and you know, IMDb and everything there is. You can get more information about me than you need, I promise.
Excellent. And you can go to thedevmethod.com/blog to get the recaps and replays from this and the previous episodes. I am at The Dev Method everywhere. You can subscribe on YouTube and or to Gold Chat on your favorite podcast platform. And Gold Chat, as I said before, is part of the Marketing Podcast Network, where I love that this is considered a marketing show, but really the show is about looking at the life you want and putting the things you need to in motion to create that. I thank you again so much. What final thought would you like to leave people with? Richard, final thought?
Wow. Art is important. Years ago, somebody said a politician running for office wanted to cut back the arts and entertainment, endowment, and he said, "You got to save art. You know, I like art as much as the next guy, but you know, when times are tough, you got to save you got to use the money for what's important. Art is important. If we don't get our art, we will become distended the way we would if we, and our bones would weaken if we didn't get that kind of nourishment. It is an essential. It's not an add-on or an extra. It's really at the core of the human experience."
I could not agree with you more on that. Art essential. Stacia, final thought?
My final thought would be keep talking to one another. There's so much power in conversations. There's beauty in conversation. We're all more alike than we are different. And we won't know that unless we actually talk to each other. So let's keep talking. Keep shining your light, because you are unique, you're different, and you bring massive value to the world.
Yes, 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 and yes. David, final thought to you.
Yeah, when trying something new, there are three fears that you can overcome each one of. The fear of the unknown. It's okay. So you just don't know something yet. The fear of failure. No, own it. You're going to fail and you're going to learn from it. And the fear of success. What happens if you're actually good at something? Think about that.
Ooh. So we have philosophy to end today's motivational, inspirational. I think anything, most anything is possible, right? You've got your skills, your background, your passion, but it's up to you to prioritize the time and practice, put those skills into play, because you never know what awesome good stuff can come when you are true to who you are and available to share that, your voice, with the world. Thank you again, Stacia Crawford, David H. Lawrence the 17th, and Richard Walter for joining me today. Thank you for tuning in, whether you're watching Gold Chat Live or listening to Gold Chat on the Marketing Podcast Network. Go out there, go for it, honor your voice, because we know You can do it.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.